Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. On December 17, 2017, the National Gallery of Art held a 75th birthday tribute to Curtis Mayfield, 1942 to 1999, American singer, writer, producer, and label owner. This program was proposed and made possible by Daryl Atwell. Remarks were presented by Aaron Cohen on the social, cultural, and political changes that shaped soul music in Chicago during the 1960s and 1970s, and how musicians themselves were often agents of those very changes. As a singer, songwriter, producer, guitarist, and entrepreneur, Curtis Mayfield stood at the center of this movement. Cohen reads excerpts from his forthcoming book, Move On Up, that describe Mayfield's working methods and his influence. Afterward, DJ Jossonic presented music related to Mayfield and his legacy. A film screening followed of Urban Soul by Ghanaian-British filmmaker John Akumfra. An example of Akumfra's work with Smoking Dog Films made for broadcast, Urban Soul uses a pop culture subject, the phenomenon of R&B, as criteria to investigate deeper themes of corporate corruption and greed.
I just wanted to make a brief anecdote. When I first told a young person, he's an artist that I met recently, he's 19 years old, we were doing this project on Curtis Mayfield, he said to me, Daryl, I had to Google him, I don't know who Curtis Mayfield is. And that's not a disparaging comment about him as a 19-year-old person, but it's testament to the fact today that history can easily get lost. And part of my whole purpose of having this connection with the gallery is to do that, to have a preservation of this history and culture, to make sure that we remember where a lot of the things that we're doing today, where it comes from, and then how important it was in developing what happens in the future. And it's a testament that all of you have come out today in such strong numbers. I'm 11 o'clock in the morning, you're skipping brunch, you're skipping NFL football. You know, so I'm really, really enthralled. And I'll just go back to what Wesley Snipes said in Spike Lee's music to Denzel Washington. They were having a debate about jazz music. And remember, Denzel was all about playing jazz from its purest form. And Wesley Snipes said, if you play the music, the people will come. With that, here's Curtis Mayfield.
Wow, thank you. Thank you all for being here again at 11 o'clock in the morning. Also want to thank Allison, Sarah, Olivia, everybody here at the National Gallery of Art. Want to thank Mike Orlov, and I want to thank my wife, LaVon, for being here with me on this journey. And I want to thank Curtis Mayfield, his family, his music, his life, his work, for making all of this possible and for making our lives so much better. I spoke a few months ago at the Smithsonian Museum of African American Arts and Culture, History and Culture, and I was going to bring this visual about Curtis Mayfield's international influence, and I forgot it, brought it here with me today. It's a Japanese publication, very thick publication involving, if anybody here can read Japanese, I could use your help. So I have it here with me, but it does indicate how beloved he is internationally, not just in communities here in the United States. I almost said community here in Chicago, shows you how locally centric I am, but I meant worldwide. I want to talk about his importance in this talk as a singer, as a songwriter, as a guitarist, as an entrepreneur, even as a movie actor, we'll talk about later. Even though we don't have Google here, we know the basics of his life. He was born in 1942. He died in 1999 toward the end of the 20th century. We know about his inspirational life. We know about how he overcame poverty. He overcame the difficulties of life in segregated Chicago in the 1950s and 60s. We know about how he overcame a horrible freak stage accident in 1990 that left him paralyzed from the neck down for 9 years, and he still recorded the beautiful album, New World Order. My book is about, it takes one of his most inspirational songs, it's his title, Move On Up, Chicago Soul Music and Black Cultural Power, because so much of great Chicago soul music was about empowerment. It was about individuals, about a community that felt empowered to create their own narratives, musical narratives, their own historical narrative. And Curtis Mayfield, that all he did, for all that he did, was in the center of all of that was going on, and is honored as such. It wouldn't have happened without him, essentially. I mentioned that he grew up in poverty. He grew up mainly in the Caprini Green housing projects on the north side of Chicago. By the way, is anybody here from Chicago?
Yeah.
All right. So we know the story of Caprini Green. We know it as, you know, the north side housing project. Some of you who watch the TV show Good Times might know that that's where it took place. But when Curtis Mayfield grew up there on Hudson Street, it was also a thriving artistic community as well, despite everything. There were singer-songwriters like himself, his friend Jerry Butler. There was Major Lance, another singer. Terry Collier, a great soul folk singer. And of course, there was Eric Monty, who went on to create Good Times and Cooley High. Curtis Mayfield, in growing up there, was surrounded by so many cosmopolitan influences. And even at a very young age, he would adapt to them and he would take them in. He would listen to them. He would hear them. His grandmother was part of a Pentecostal church on the west side, Traveling Soul Spiritual Church. Gospel harmonies and the church's vision played a big part in his work. But he was also interested in blues. A lot of people don't know that, but he was a big fan of Howlin' Wolf, Muddy Waters. There was a jazz saxophonist in Chicago, a great jazz saxophonist named Von Freeman. And I once asked Von Freeman if he ever met Curtis Mayfield. And he told me the only time he met Curtis Mayfield when Curtis Mayfield came up to jam on guitar with Jimmy Reed. So just imagining these guys jamming together is just enough to put me in musical heaven. But my point is that he was working in a community. He was also influenced by reading, by the works of Paul Laurence Dunbar, the great poet. Maybe not so heralded was he was also influenced by the works of Dr. Seuss in terms of rhyming, in terms of narrative, in terms of uplifting messages. He was a self-taught guitarist, tuning his guitar to the black keys and the piano. We'll talk more about that in a bit, and that's sort of for the musicians in the house. But also, as a lot of us know, he was in this group called The Impressions when he was at a young, very young age. He was 16, playing guitar, singing. His friend, Jerry Butler, was singing lead. And I'm not going to tell you the whole story here, but they were making the rounds as teenagers. They had a very devoted manager, a man named Eddie Thomas, and they recorded a song called For Your Precious Love, which, clap your hands if you've heard it. You've probably not heard the version I'm about to play. It's a demo version, 1957. And Curtis was 15 years old playing guitar on this track. This is a very raw demo of For Your Precious Love. And you can already hear the teenage brilliance at work. And you can hear his backup vocals. Jerry sang lead. Here Curtis sang backup. His talents were not quite yet known, but they were coming. And I want to play the track. So the demo version of For Your Precious Love.
Tell them that
that they don't know. For as long as you're in love with me, our love will grow wider, so much deeper than any sea. And of all the things that I want in this whole wide world is just for you to say that you'll be mine. And whoa,
I'm so surprised,
darling, when I
realize
that you
in me.
But darling,
wanting you,
just wanting you,
I'm lonely and
blue. I'm so lonely.
Now, this might sound hard to believe, but the little record company they recorded that for did not want to release it. They didn't think it would be successful. It was a little company called Bandera, which of course nobody's heard of. They didn't have any sense. So they made the trip down Record Row in Chicago, where the record companies all had their offices on South Michigan Avenue, and they recorded for VJ. They did a different version of this song that was a hit, big hit. Group breaks up for different reasons. And the point about all of that is that at a very young age, Curtis Mayfield saw, I mean, he's 16, 17, 18. He saw the ups and downs of the record industry with a wisdom that people much older than him still don't have. So around that time, 1960, he and his manager, Eddie Thomas, decided to become their own executives. Curtis was 18 years old. Eddie was slightly older. He was maybe in his mid-20s. And they formed Curtom Publishing. Curtis, Kurt, Eddie Thomas, Tom, Curtom. They named it after themselves. Now, precedents did exist for young African-American artists controlling their own music, most notably former Chicagoan Sam Cooke. But Sam Cooke started his company after he was famous. These guys are young upstarts starting it. And Curtis Mayfield came here to DC. He said to a journalist, Agnes Smith, he said, "The first time I visited Washington, I went to the Library of Congress and asked someone to give me whatever information pertained to music and copyrights. All I had in my assets column were those little songs as I was writing them." Eddie Thomas told me, "We were going to the School of Hard Knocks ourselves, and we were learning. We were also learning that the publishing was very important to participate in regards to getting some returns. We knew that if we had a piece of our own label, we'd have a little bit more slice of the pie than just being artists on someone else's label." The label grew, and it grew. Curtis also formed a musical partnership with a wonderful arranger named Johnny Pate. And this was part of the whole idea that I mentioned earlier of Curtis getting a community together, being the inspiration for a community. Johnny Pate, who was significantly older, was a very seasoned jazz bassist. You can find his jazz records on eBay for a lot of money. They're very rare. But he was also a classically trained, conservatory trained musician. Johnny Pate, being older, coming from jazz, coming from the classical conservatory, didn't know what to make of this upstart Curtis Mayfield and his friends, the Reformed Impressions, Curtis with his own sort of weird guitar tuning. But he thought, you know, let's work together. Their first collaboration was a song that we might have known called Monkey Time. You've heard that. It was a singer named Major Lance, who also grew up in Cabrini Green, and the Impressions served as his backup vocals. And it was a huge hit, and it solidified what became known as the Chicago sound. It was based on Curtis Mayfield's writing, his co-producing, Johnny Pate's arranging. Now, I'm not going to play that song. I want to play another song that Curtis Mayfield wrote for Major Lance called Rhythm. By the way, speaking of Major Lance, I don't know if you know this, Major Lance's daughter, Keisha Lance Bottoms, was just elected mayor of Atlanta. So a few weeks ago, first woman African-American mayor of Atlanta. And Major Lance and Curtis moved from Chicago to Atlanta in the 1970s. But so it all goes around. It all sort of, you know, the music, the politics, social movements, they come together and it goes more than one generation with Keisha's victory, well-deserved victory in Atlanta. So I'm gonna play this track called Rhythm. Now, Rhythm to me is, which is written by Curtis, performed by Major Lance, produced and arranged by Johnny Pate. Rhythm is one of those songs that just make you feel good the moment you hear it. There's also this really interesting mix of Johnny Pate's low-end brass sound. There's Curtis Mayfield's chord progressions, and there's a Latin percussion underneath, and Afro-Latin percussion would play a very big part in Curtis Mayfield's solo records as well, years later. But it was always something that recurred throughout his music. And the beauty is in the call and response here too. Curtis said to another journalist, Sue Cassidy, he said, "Usually through most of my original things have basic ideas and thoughts in terms of little interludes, and that I hear some of the instruments doing. Therefore, I dictate these things to Mr. Johnny Pate. And he, with his own ways of bringing things about, comes up with beautiful things. There's a great collaboration there." And this is that collaboration. So here's the track Rhythm, written by Curtis Mayfield, performed by Major Lance. I mean, to me, this song says everything about Chicago music in the early 60s. We had Curtis Mayfield's writing, his call and response. We had the jazz influence. We have, you know, the Afro-Latin percussion. I mean, this was it. I want to talk a bit about Curtis Mayfield's guitar playing, which is starting to come out more now. And for someone like Johnny Pate, again, conservatory musician, a jazz performer, working with Curtis Mayfield proved a distinctive challenge for him. Mayfield always tuned his guitar in F sharp, an approach that came about when he was growing up and self-taught and had his strings correspond to the black keys on his mother's piano. By the way, if you go to YouTube, you can find a gazillion people who are trying to teach you how to play like that. Don't trust any of them. However, and I can give you more details, there was a great article in Premier Guitar magazine by a guy named Michael Ross. It actually is a really great, fantastic instruction for trying to get as close as humanly possible to playing guitar like Curtis did. But in addition to his tuning, and here I am playing air guitar, but he also had an open feel as a rhythm player. Now, a lot of times with funk guitarists, it's very tight. You know, we think about tightness in the guitar. Pardon me, it's my teenage self. With that looseness, Curtis Mayfield had a rolling quality in his guitar playing. And there was a couple people who could approximate that to the best of their abilities. One was a man in Chicago named Phil Upchurch. The other was this guitarist named Jimi Hendrix, who had opened for Curtis on a tour and just tried to adapt that style as best he could. Actually, if you're listening to Jimi Hendrix song like Little Wing, you can hear him trying to be Curtis Mayfield on guitar. Pate said about Curtis, he said, he did not tune the guitar the conventional way. I don't know what system it was, but most of the tunes he wrote were written in the key of G flat or F sharp or B natural. These are keys that the average musician doesn't want to have to deal with because there are too many sharps and flats. But this is the way that Curtis tuned his guitar. That's how he wrote, and that's how he sang. When I started working with him, I had no problem because I was dealing with the interval system. So an F sharp could be no different than a C. F sharp is the root, and then there is no problem at all. You know where C sharp is naturally going to be the fifth. You do it interval wise. I've never had any problems with any singers if they want to do it in some odd keys. Real musicians have no problems with strange keys. So that's for all you musos in the audience here. And then the highlight of the Mayfield-Pate synergy to me is the song People Get Ready. It was recorded in January 1965. It reached number 3 on the national R&B charts, number 14 on the pop charts. It's been covered a million times. Some versions much better than others. Curtis's and the Impressions is the best, although the Chambers Brothers is very good. But it reflected the songwriter's spiritual emphasis in vivid colors. Its image of a train leaving the station for a higher place would have conveyed special resonance for migrants and their children in Chicago who had come up from the South. The lyric's relevance to the church-inspired civil rights movement has been frequently discussed. But along with these words, the melody, paradoxically both languid and momentous, and the sweeping orchestration that eschewed horns, would offer inspiration to starkly different groups of local activists, and by local activists, I mean in Chicago. In August of that year, 500 advocates for open housing in the upscale North Shore suburbs sang a version with their own verses advocating community integration as they marched through the exclusive suburbs of Winnetka, Kenilworth, Wilmette, and the less exclusive Evanston. About 4 years later, supporters of the jailed West Side-based Illinois Black Panther Party chairman Fred Hampton sang their version of this tune at their rally. They changed the lyrics to advocate for Fred Hampton's freedom and to urge preparation for revolution. So we had very different groups of activists in Chicago, from people wanting to integrate the wealthy North Shore, people on the West Side wanting to free Fred Hampton. They're all using the melody of People Get Ready for their inspiration. And that's along with these wonderful lyrics and the wonderful strings that make me just melt every time I hear them. So we have to play People Get Ready.
Get on board. All you need is faith to hear the dealers honking. Don't need no ticket. You just thank the Lord. So people get ready for the train to join. Open the doors. hopeless sinner who would hurt all mankind.
Just to save his own.
Believe me now, have pity on those whose chances grow thinner. For there's no hiding place against the kingdom's throne. So people get ready, there's a train a-coming. You don't need no baggage, you just get on board. All you need is faith to hear the diesel's humming. Don't need no ticket, you just thank the Lord.
Isn't that magical? I just remembered, actually, different people covering it. There's also, if anybody here is familiar with the militant group The Last Poets, even they covered it. So it just, the influence was just so far and wide, no matter where you were on the civil rights spectrum. 2 years later, November 1967, and the Impressions Socially Conscious Were a Winner broke on the airwaves, but not everywhere. The single might have frightened some white radio station programmers. We're a Winner alters the message of People Get Ready. People Get Ready, Keep on Pushing. Those songs echoed black gospel music, but they were also universal in tone. We're a Winner denotes a different, unmistakably African-American dimension. The song contains numerous elements, unmistakably black, from the way Mayfield phrases Lord have mercy to the background shout of Sakatumi. He asserts that we're true from the good black earth and urges keep on pushing like your leaders tell you to, full of verve and connotating a new attitude. It was also at this time that Kurtom Records became independent. Curtis Mayfield told journalist Sue Cassidy Clark in 1968, "We're a Winner, again, is a song. I speak of this as a song with a message to all, and yet basically to the black masses of people. It's an inspiration, an inspiring song in which I believe should be put out. Everybody, every once in a while, should sing in terms of trying to keep the movements going. Even though things are a bit tougher than usual sometimes, I can look back over my life as well as back over the years that I've read about, and I feel that though things are slow sometimes and really hung up with the movement, that we truly are a winner." One of the stations that didn't play it was a pop radio station in Chicago, WLS. Another thing about the song's lyrics, too, that I want to mention is an interesting thing, and this is for anybody here like me who also teaches. We're a Winner is technically not grammatically correct. As you know, if you wanted to be a grammarian stick in the mud, it should be we are winners. However, number one, dialect is great in songs. Number two, we're a winner constitutes community. Constitutes a collective. We are together. And I don't know if Curtis, when he wrote the song, meant it that way, but that's how it's reverberated, is we are a collective community. We are a winner, not we are separate winners. The Jet Magazine at that time, when this whole radio station thing was happening, looked into if there was a nationwide attempt to ban We're a Winner from the airwaves beyond Chicago. The radio station personnel who they quote and their critics remain anonymous in the article. But across the country, most of them claim to be playing the record. It has a positive message, they said, and had not received any kind of white backlash. The exceptions were a station in a smaller southern city and another in a major midwestern city, possibly Chicago. And the radio station programmer said, "There's been a lot of race friction here, and we were worried that if we played the record, we might get criticized for stirring things up. But now I'm beginning to think we ought to play it." So whatever programming decision WLS made, the station's refusal on this song had shown that this AM outlet, while it remained powerful, could not claim any kind of control over young consumers. The same could be said for other stations that may have declined to play the record. We're a Winner rose to number 14 on the Billboard pop charts and first place in the R&B ranking. Now, ironically, and this is something that people forget about Curtis Mayfield and the way he was received at the time, too, is that certain elements of the very left-wing community were dismissive as well, very wrong-headed, of course. One of them was a musicologist named Arnold Shaw, who felt that the Impressions were not radical enough. And again, his thoughts are a long-buried polemic, but they serve as a reminder that among some, Curtis Mayfield's message was slighted at the time among even, you know, so-called progressive white scholars. In Shaw's book, The World of Soul, his derogatory and baseless comments included calling the Impressions, this is his quote, Oreo singers. And then Shaw assumes that their performances would be picketed by black student unions during the era of large student demonstrations. He cites the May 1969 hit, Choice of Colors, as an example of Mayfield's suggestion that education as a means to advancement, rather than, say, rioting, as an example of what he thought was Curtis Mayfield's moderate approach. However, Shaw overlooked the African-American students at Howard University, right here in D.C., who sang We're a Winner to celebrate their victorious demand for a black research institute. So another thing that was derided at the time was some white kids in hippie San Francisco, including a white kid dressed in revolution hip, according to Rolling Stone, who derided the group as black capitalists. Now, of course, these folks had no idea that there was a long history of African Americans taking on business endeavors such as publishing their own literary works, despite entrenched opposition. And these business ventures, such as Curtis's Kurtom Records, show that these sort of means of production, controlling them, can be much more challenging to the orthodoxy than observable militancy. For instance, in the book, along with the Impressions music, their entrepreneurship addressed the actualities of local, state, and national power that prominent essayist Albert Murray called for in his book, The Omni-Americans. Curtis and his staff were engaged in local control in Chicago through starting their own business, not through any kind of posturing. When Where Winner was released, when they launched Kurtom Records, the office was on the south side of Chicago, and it also served as numerous R&B artists were coming to the label. Through trial and error, Curtis, Eddie Thomas made Kurtom succeed. They made it all come together. And what comes next after that, we know. Curtis Mayfield launched a solo career, continued releasing other artists on his label from the garage rock band Baby Huey and the Babysitters, soul harmony groups like the Natural Four, the Impressions, even without Curtis's involvement, and of course his protege, the brilliant Donny Hathaway, another product of Howard University. There were films, film soundtracks like Superfly, and I'll talk more about these soundtracks in a bit, but mostly being on his own label, working in his own time and place, Curtis Mayfield was able to connect to the times, but also was able to expand his own sound within his own small group format. I believe that his biggest achievement on record as a solo artist was Curtis Live, which captured January 1971 concerts in New York. It was funny because one of the when I spoke about Curtis in June, someone asked me about his political relevance today, and I use in Curtis Live, well, it was during the administration of a corrupt Republican president. Curtis Mayfield on Curtis Live made fun of corrupt vice president Spiro Agnew. So if you want to think there's parallels to today, I, you know, leave that up to you. But also, too, his statement about, you know, still fighting the good fight despite everything also holds true today. I want to play the We're a Winner that was part of Curtis Live. And you can hear that rolling guitar sound. And here it's Curtis with his second guitarist, a guy named Craig McMullen. And there was also, along with the rhythm section of Tyrone McCullen and bassist Joseph Lucky Scott, there was a percussionist, Henry Gibson. Now, as I mentioned earlier, Afro-Latin percussion was always a part of Curtis's worldview, his perspective. Here, it's much more prominent. On one of the songs on Curtis Live is Mighty Mighty. And when Curtis Mayfield sings just over Master Henry Gibson's percussion, he sings, "We don't need no music, we got conga. we don't need no music, we got soul. So he was upending any kind of like elements of classical Western musical theory as to what music is. For Curtis, music is whatever I want it to be. Here, it's me singing with Master Henry Gibson on percussion. Also on this album, actually, he does a very nice version of The Carpenters, We've Only Just Begun. He was, you know, very open in his listening. So I want to play this version of We're a Winner, because you can hear his guitar playing clearer. And you can also hear a very militant verse that was on this version, not on the 1967 version. So if radio stations like WLS feared the version that was released officially, they wouldn't have even touched this one. So let's hear We're a Winner from Curtis Live.
Jet and Johnson Publications. A whole lot of stations didn't want to play that particular record, We're a Winner. Can you imagine such a thing? Well, I would say the way I'm sure most of you would say, we don't give a damn, we're a winner anyway. Right on? Yeah, I got a little strength out there tonight. Putting fire under us. Out of sight. It's all right now. We have just another version that we'd like to lay to you about here. Believing very strongly in the equality and freedom for all, and especially we people who are darker than blue. We'd like to just lay another version to you. Trying not to offend anyone, but basically telling it like it is. Never let anybody say, boy, you can't make it, cause a feeble mind is in your way. No more tears do we cry, the black boy done dried his eyes. And we're moving on up, moving on up. Lord have mercy, we're moving on up now, moving on up. There'll be no more Uncle Tom, at last that blessed day has come, and we're a winner. And everybody knows the truth. We just keep on pushing, like Martin Luther told you to. And I don't mind leaving here to show the world we have no fear, cause we're moving on up, moving on up. Lord have mercy, we're moving on up, we're moving on up. So people get ready, I've got good news for you. How how we got over.
You hear that rolling guitar here.
Like we're all supposed to do. Let us all say amen. And together we'll clap our hands. Cause we're moving on up. Moving on up. Lord have mercy, we're moving on up now. Moving on up. Continue to be a winner, all of you.
So that's a great track. Now, as mentioned, I mentioned a little bit ago, it's funny, it's easy to lose track of time when playing Curtis Mayfield music. As mentioned a little bit ago, Curtis Mayfield got into recording soundtracks. And just after this Curtis Live was recorded, he recorded Superfly, which was the big famous one. And that had his own songs with Johnny Pates writing and arranging as well. It turned into a bigger industry for Curtis. Claudine, which he wrote, and Gladys Knight and the Pips performed. Sparkle, as we know, which he wrote, Aretha Franklin sang. Let's Do It Again, which the Staple Singers sang. He was able to get the Staple Singers to sing about romance as opposed to church, which was another story altogether. That's another story. So he was riding high on soundtracks. But then in 1977, I want to make sure I have time to play this video clip. He took a big risk, and I think this is one of the more lesser known but more admirable aspects of his soundtrack work. There was a play by a Puerto Rican playwright named Oscar Piñeiro called Short Eyes, and it was harsh. I mean, this play is about prisoners in New York who can't afford bail, so they're in jail, and there's gang struggles between Puerto Rican gangs, black gangs, white gangs, and there's a simmering tension, simmering animosity. A white child molester is sent to jail, and that completely changes the whole racial dynamic. So this doesn't sound like it would be a popular feel-good movie, but Curtis Mayfield felt very strongly about it. He felt so strongly about it that he put up the money to produce it, he did the score, he performed it. He also acted in it. So one of the reasons I want to play this clip is this is one acting. And his manager at the time, a guy named Marv Hyman, told me that the reason why Curtis put up the money for it was he thought it would be a hit, like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, you know, a play about an asylum. But I think, and again, I don't know this for sure, but I think one of the reasons why Curtis Mayfield felt so strongly about this film was because Superfly showed the high-end, high-living of criminal activity. You see this movie, and you're going to want to do anything to stay out of jail. I mean, it's that harsh. It's gritty. It's hard to watch. I have to give a trigger warning before I show this clip. There's some bad language in the film. So if you have younger, more sensitive people, I have to let you know. I mean, it takes place in a prison. But just letting you know, fair warning, trigger warning, as they say, as I say in class. So Curtis actually, in the scene, he is the grizzled elder statesman of the black gang. He's at the ripe old age of 34, and he's the elder statesman. So he plays a leader of the black gang. He breaks up an assault. And then there's a musical number, which I do not believe Piñeiro had in the script, but it was a song called Doo-Doo-Wop Is Strong in Here. And it kind of breaks the tension in a way because it's this gritty, hard-edged, very violent prison film. And then there's this song and dance number. However, number one, it's a great song. Number two, in terms of the narrative, it shows the one bit where there can be hope for people to come together, which is quickly broken apart. And I didn't really talk about Curtis Mayfield singing yet, so I'm about to do so now. He had, as we know, a beautiful high tenor low falsetto, which seems very delicate. And this song, which he wrote, which is about prison life, he sings in this very high-end, not very harsh, aggressive, but a very high-end tone. And that makes a really interesting contrast musically. And like I say, as an actor, he didn't do a bad job, especially considering that this is his one acting role. So I'm going to show you a 6-minute clip from Short Eyes. Again, violent language included.
Check out the shower.
There's Curtis. There's Curtis in the glasses, as we probably can guess.
Coco.
There'll be no takeoffs on this floor.
I mean, what you talking about?
Don't play no games, Ice.
Let me tell you something, man. If a dude is willing to up it, then I'm gonna take it. That's all there is to it.
That's right, Jim. If the kid is willing to up a shot of life, I'm willing to live.
Ain't nobody willing to give up nothing but hard times and bubble gum. And you know they don't allow chewing gum in the joint.
And we're the hard times.
And you're serious.
You're as serious as terminal cancer. And that is the final stage, Brother Man. So long as I'm on the floor, there won't be no young kid giving up a shot of life.
Which might not be too long.
¿Y qué carajo tú quieres hacer con eso, maricón de mierda?
Say if you think you're bad.
Man, I don't think I'm bad. I know I'm bad.
Hey, Robert, hold up. Get him, hold up, Robert. Hold up,
man. You heard me. What's going on this floor?
Ain't nothing but a little doo-wop.
You better doo-wop back into that day room.
Battling beauties are at it again. All right, let's move back to the day room.
What's your problem?
I'm going to myself. Bang my hand.
Hey, get your feet off the bench. If you let them, they'll drive you ape shit.
Nice things are happening here today.
Okay?
Yo, motherfucker, don't want me here? Bail me the fuck out. Get your commissary slips together. Yo, fuck y'all.
Yeah, keep on stepping.
That's right. Ask your mama to bail you out, bitch.
Hey, that's right, ladies and gentlemen, damas y caballeros. Every night is Latin night here at the House of Detention. Today I got a showing up show for you. Got my man Willie Boom 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 Bing Bing Bang. Then I keep it bound. In it, got a voice, got a voice. Louis Face, por favor. Hey, Longstreet, sure you ready for the steps, man? Don't do that. Mira, my boss, my boss, señor y señora. Venimos que sepa que aquí estamos teniendo un pedal de música tremendo con el hombre con el pavo, por favor.
Este, thanks.
Cuando yo la vi por primera vez, yo me enamoré. Claro, sus labios, su boca, su forma de hablar. Qué linda es, ah, qué linda es.
You want to take them off, man?
You don't know somebody else's.
I'm here.
So, hey, you know, I'm with that mano, fuck it.
I'm with it, man, I'm down.
Yeah, Paco, you gotta watch out for Paco también, you know,
good thing. Bring it, Pappy!
Yes, sir.
too proud to die here as well.
Have no idea who that guy is. Have no idea. And he's only in this scene. It's really, like, bizarre. That's actually the one bit of levity in the film. The rest of the film is really harsh. What happened after the release of Short Eyes was disco happened. Curtis released a few disco records. They didn't do well. He produced some disco records for other artists that did better, Linda Clifford in Chicago, for instance. He moves to Atlanta around 1980. Kurtom Records shuts down. But even after he moved to Atlanta, he was still engaged with Chicago and politics in Chicago. A lot of people don't know this, but Curtis Mayfield was one of the first celebrities to endorse Harold Washington when Harold Washington ran for mayor in 1983 and became the first African-American mayor in Chicago. It was reported at the Times, but really hasn't been acknowledged today. Curtis is in Atlanta. We know in 1990, there was that horrible stage accident where he's on stage in Wingate Park in Brooklyn, and wind blows a lighting fixture, leaving him paralyzed from the neck down for the last 9 years of his life. Yet he still records New World Order, as I had mentioned. But I want to end here before, because I want to get some time for questions and answers. His influence, Jimi Hendrix, Bob Marley, in Chicago, the rapper Common, Kendrick Lamar, can all trace their what they do to what Curtis did. Beyond music, in 2004, January 2004, I remember it was Martin Luther King's birthday, and I told my girlfriend, now wife, LaVon, who's sitting right here, I said, you know, one of my professors is running for office. We should go to his campaign office. Be a fun thing to do today, and there's free food. I'm in graduate school, so, you know. And he's a good guy. He's a good guy. And so we get to this office on the west side of Chicago, and I really do believe the office was on Mayfield Avenue on the west side. I am not imagining that. And we're there. It was about 50 people. The candidate comes on to the song, Move On Up. And as you probably have guessed, that candidate was Barack Obama. So that sort of, you know, shows you his influence around the world, around Chicago, around politics and everything. I want to have some time for questions before a great DJ comes on. So does anybody have any questions? I can't see any hands. Yes, in front here. See.
I'm just wondering if you noted the uncanny resemblance between the voice of Pharrell Williams and the voice of Curtis Mayfield. Have you noticed that?
That tenor high falsetto. And you know, and there was also the Atlanta hip-hop group Outkast as well on Players Ball. So definitely that way of singing has certainly reverberated through hip-hop. Yeah, Pharrell Williams, which isn't really hip-hop, it's more R&B hip-hop pop, but yeah, definitely. And it was an upbeat song too, like early Curtis Mayfield Impressions recordings. Maybe Happy was the rhythm of our day. Other questions? Yes. Well, yes. I mean, Curtis himself was very anti-drug, and he felt that the movie, and this was his words, was like a cocaine commercial. And he was, when he saw the finished product, was, you know, yeah. And I think, again, like I said earlier, I think that maybe is one of the reasons why he decided to fund Short Eyes, was because aside from that one clip, it shows you that prison life is not good, you know. So, yeah. Yes. I see you in the sweater. Yes. Well, he, right before the accident, and he started recording with people like Ice-T, And he was good friends with Chuck D from Public Enemy. And he really felt that rap and hip hop that had a message he was into. And of course, they sampled him all the time. And he wanted to get paid for those samples. So the message he was down with, the using his music, no, it was, yeah, he even after his accident, he and his management went after people who were either bootlegging, pirating his music, because that was actually a thing back in the 90s, or sampling it without permission. Yes?
There was a songwriter group, I think, led by Jerry Butler.
Jerry Butler, I talk about that in the book, yes. Songwriters Workshop. No, he wasn't, because he was doing his own thing. And the Songwriters Workshop, Jerry Butler had a collective of songwriters, Chuck Jackson and Marvin Yancey, Terry Collier, who I mentioned. If you ever heard a song by the Dells called The Love We Had Stays On My Mind, that came out of the Songwriters Workshop. But it was basically Jerry Butler doing what Curtis was doing. Since Curtis was already doing it, he didn't need, you know, them. But I mean, some of them, like Chuck Jackson, did go on to do work for Kurtom later on. Yes?
I'm just curious about his children and how they are carrying on his legacy or any contact you have.
Well, I'm friends with Curtis III, the oldest son who was supposed to be here. He can't make it. He's a brilliant info technology guy, and he got called in to do high-end computer work, and he's a musician too. And I know there's a lot of, you know, different children, and they all run the estate in different ways and have different aspects. Todd Mayfield wrote recently a book about his father, and there's some family issues with that I don't really want to go into right now because that would take up an hour. But they're all doing different things with the estate, yes, in different capacities.
I guess more specifically, what I was asking was,
how are they doing this? Well, Curtis III, the oldest one, who is in addition to being an infotech genius, is a producer, and he's discovered a lot of great young talent in Chicago, and he records, he also composes himself, and being a mentor to a lot of younger people in Chicago. And that's why I wish Curtis III could have been here, is he could have spoke much better about his own work than I could about his work, you know. But, you know, again, another wonderful generational shift. And it's funny, too. Curtis's young daughter, when she was like 10 or something, Curtis told me that she started playing guitar. And I said, oh, does she tune it to F sharp? And he says she knows. She knows the family history. Other questions? Yes?
I guess when I look at these movies that Curtis has scribed the soundtrack for, I'm just so amazed that he captured the essence and the nuance of what was going on in these movies, like Piece of the Action.
Sure.
Can you comment on some of his process of how he did these soundtracks? Like, did he go in there with
Gordon Parks Jr., yeah. Superfly he wrote before he saw the film. Others he would do differently. Sometimes he saw rough cuts, sometimes he didn't. Sometimes they used songs that he had written earlier. Claudine used some of his songs, like Suffer, which he had written earlier. To Be Invisible, which he had written earlier. So it varied. It varied. And this one, Short Eyes, he had more hands-on involvement in, as a, you know, involvement. I think there's a DJ who's going to play. I don't want to go over his time because, you know, we're kind of over. So, you know, he just waved me off. But he's a wonderful DJ. And, you know, I'll be, you know, hanging out here if you want to speak some more. But we want to hear this great music here that he has programmed for us. Thank you all. Thank you for being here. Thank you to the National Gallery of Art. And again, anybody who can read Japanese, who can help me with this, please. Oh, and by the way, thanks for the correction, too, about the Atlanta mayoral. I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Hello? Okay, great. Thank you guys again for coming out. And can we hear it for Aaron? I mean, this was amazing. And it's hard for me to follow such an amazing presentation of Curtis Mayfield's music. I was really young when a lot of this was happening. I was born in the early 70s. So for me, Curtis Mayfield was what the grown folks listened to. You know, my mom would clean the house, or when she and her girlfriends were going out, you know, you'd hear Curtis Mayfield. But, you know, for what I do in terms of playing music, you know, Aaron mentioned a very important thing, which is the continuum of music, of Curtis's music through people using it and sampling it. And a lot of people here, I see people who are close to my age or younger, who grew up on hip hop and know that, I mean, people pillaged Curtis Mayfield's catalog. I mean, everybody did, Kanye, Jay-Z, Mary. And so what I've been doing in my work a lot is trying to play those songs and to expose people to the fact that this man who is a musical genius, I mean, honestly, I mean, he had a career that lasted, you know, what, almost 45 years before he passed. You know, he started when he was a teenager, when he was 15 years old. You know, when I was 15 years old, what was I doing? I was playing video games. This man was teaching himself to play guitar and writing these songs. So it's really humbling to be exposed to that kind of talent. So what I'm going to do, Curtis Mayfield, some of his music was much more down-tempo and mellow in tone. But as Aaron mentioned also, in the late 70s, most artists were doing disco records. They were doing so because they were forced to do so, either at gunpoint by their labels, literally, or due to market forces. You know, Curtis Mayfield, he had his own label, so he was looking at the way the tea leaves were blowing, and he said, well, I have to make a disco record. So, you know, everyone knows the story of, does everyone know the story of Disco Demolition Night in Chicago? Raise your hand if you know that story. Okay, a few of you. This was a very unfortunate thing that happened in Chicago in the late 70s. A radio jock called Steve Dahl hosted Disco Demolition Night, which was really a backlash against disco music because it had become very popular in the late 70s and had displaced rock music as the preferred pop music of the time. And as we all know, disco came out of the black community, the Latino community, and it was really fueled by like the gay community as well. So this was really a racist, anti-person of color, anti-gay backlash. But Curtis Mayfield, when he adopted, you know, he just basically gave up and said, I'm gonna make some disco records. Even though Steve Dahl's phrase was disco sucks, and they actually went to Comiskey Park and blew up disco records in the middle of the field on a night in between a doubleheader baseball game. You listen to what Curtis Mayfield was doing even in that genre, and I'm gonna play some of it very shortly. I'll stop talking soon. You listen to what Curtis Mayfield was doing in that genre, the quality of what he was doing compared to some of the stuff that was admittedly terrible and was what really fueled that backlash. You could hear, you know, what the hell were people talking about? Pardon my French. I mean, even in this genre that was being reviled, Curtis Mayfield managed to make stuff that was of amazing quality. And a lot of people sampled it. And you'll hear some songs and you go, oh, wow, I didn't know this person did it. So the last thing I'll say is Johnny Pate, which we talked about earlier, he's how old now? 93. He's 93 years old right now. I'm going to play, the first song I'm going to play is not going to be a Curtis Mayfield song, it's going to be a Johnny Pate song. Some of you people who are Jay-Z fans are going to immediately know, you know, oh wow, this sample. And it also references the Afro-Latin percussion that was very prevalent in the work of Johnny Pate through Curtis Mayfield all the way through Donny Hathaway. If you listen to songs like the Ghetto, especially the live version, which has a whole 5-minute interlude of Afro-Latin percussion. So that being said, I'm going to start playing some records. You can hang out, you can dance, you can do the chair dance, you can snap your fingers, you can do whatever you want to do. And if you want to come up and ask me questions, you can come up and ask me questions while I'm working. It's totally fine. I'm here for you. So thank you guys. I'm just going to get started. Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.